you know, they do not want to go to the expenses of bringing in special shipments of pork for the Christian employees. That's their choice. Yes, that's it. Okay, now, some of you will hear or have heard the term Shiite Muslim and Sunni Muslim, okay? The Shiites usually referring to the people of Iran, and to some degree to the people of Iraq. And the point is that there is, according to the Orthodox view of Islam, just one Islam. There's no Shiite and Sunni. Sunni actually means Orthodox. And when you're referring to Shiite Muslims, their belief concerning God and man and the relationship actually are outside of the bounds of Orthodox Islam. It's like, for example, the Mormons in comparison to the rest of Christianity. Mormons are not considered to be Christian by the Christian world. Mormons, Jehovah's Witness, you know, and other groups, they're considered sects, you know, sects which have broken off from mainstream Christianity. Similarly, the Shiites of Iran are considered as a sect which has broken off from mainstream Islam. And the difference in the views, fundamentally, is in the concept of God. In that, the Shiites believe in certain individuals who were descendants of Prophet Muhammad, some of his grandchildren, great-grandchildren. A group of them, 12, who they call the Imams, the 12 Imams. They believe that these Imams are omniscient, that they have knowledge of all things, past, present, and future. Whereas Orthodox Islam holds that that is only with God. God alone knows the past, present, and future. They hold that these Imams, for example, were infallible, totally, from birth to death. Total infallibility, according to Orthodox Islam, belongs only to God. Even prophets committed errors. But infallibility in the total sense belongs only to God. So that, and you go on to a number of other principles which exist within that concept, the God concept of God and man within Shiaism, it teaches a different view than that of Orthodox Islam. So it represents a deviation. It doesn't mean that every single Shiite has deviated, because as individuals you may speak to them and they may not hold this view. But this is the official view. So looking at the system of Shiaism from an official point of view, they have deviated. Well, this is part of the claim that of the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, you know, the right to rule and to lead the Muslim nation became the sole right of these selected descendants. Because if you say they're infallible, and they're omniscient, and they have power over the atoms of the universe, you know, ultimate power over the atoms of the universe, then surely these are the people who should be leading you. But the majority of Muslims didn't recognize that. So they would not accept them as having the sole right to lead. So, on one hand, this division began as a political difference, and it evolved into a religious and ideological difference. Well, from Islamic teachings concerning resurrection, when a person dies, the body is recreated and the spirit joins that body. So after judgment, the body and the spirit will go either to heaven or to hell. Yes, it will be a new body. Well, nobody has entered paradise at this point in time. I mean, at the time of judgment, you know, paradise is not, I mean, it is not in terms of space, where we can say, like, you know, the earth is overpopulated, so we're worried about the overpopulation of paradise. No, I mean, in that state, and that after resurrection and judgment, that state is a state which is not bounded by, you know, our dimensions in the sense that we know it. Sure. Well, the point is that, as it's described in the Quran, when a person dies, is judged, if he's judged of those to go to paradise, then in paradise, that individual has whatever he wishes. You know, there are no limitations. And as God has created the universe, and we are unable to determine where the universe ends, all of the people to the time of the destruction of the world and resurrection, I'm sure, would not be sufficient to fill this universe. So we have no problem of, you know, spaces, like, you know, you have some people believe in 144,000 go to heaven, after that the door is closed, right? You didn't make it, right? No. From Islamic point of view, there's no set number, you know, who are going to paradise. I mean, this is as God wills. Okay. Okay, give another chance, another. Okay, we'll come back. Could you raise your voice a little bit, please? Pardon? A pure Muslim country encourages other faiths to flourish. According to Islamic law, with the exception of Saudi Arabia, all other countries where Muslim rule exists, Christians may build their churches, you know, Jews may build their synagogues and worship freely. You know, they are not prohibited from doing so. And historically speaking, as I mentioned before, in Muslim Spain, Christianity, Judaism flourished. Actually, the period in Spain was considered the golden age of Jewish religion. And same thing in North Africa, in Yemen. So, but in Saudi Arabia, an exception has been made by the Prophet himself that this area, because it contains the two sanctuaries, the immediate outer area would be an area in which Christians and Jews would not be allowed to set up institutions. Not that they could not be there, they could be there, practice the religion privately in the privacy of your home or whatever, but to set up institutions, it would not be allowed specifically for this area.
Telling me is that when it comes to religion, other Muslim countries give their people a second choice, and they are not allowed to have a second choice. How can they choose between right and wrong? There's nothing to do.
Well, it's not a question that a Muslim is one who simply knows to choose between right and wrong. No, I'm not saying that it is simply that. I'm saying, of course, Islam teaches what is right and what is wrong, and encourages the people to choose between right and wrong. However, when you're talking about the issue of a sanctuary, you're talking about the issue of a sanctuary, this is something different. Because this was something instituted by the Prophet himself. It's not something which the people of Saudi Arabia of late made a decision to do. This is something which was instructed by the Prophet himself. And this was to help to preserve the pure nature of the main two sanctuaries of the Muslim world. This is the purpose. Not that knowledge of Christianity is itself prohibited. You can go to any of the universities here. I mean, though Bibles are not in circulation on the market, you can go to any of the institutions here, universities, Bibles are available. So it is not like a prohibited book to the point where nobody can ever see it, okay?
By law, I cannot even have my wife mail me anything that contains chloroform because it was legally confiscated and I can get in trouble violating the local law. And that is a law through the APO and the local postal system. Now, just saying, if I go to the postal system right now and ask them what are the items that I cannot send or out or in from Saudi Arabia, pork is one of them and all kinds of religious materials are completely forbidden. Even though it's my personal religion, it's my personal mail, if it is open, like many items that are open that are coming to this country from other places, it will be confiscated. And I will be deprived of my desire to be what I want, even though I do not bring it in to share it with people, because people will use it. But it's forbidden. And if I am caught breaking the law, then I am liable to be charged with the law.
Okay. But before, let me respond to this point, okay? One, Christians who are coming into the country, according to law, each individual is allowed to bring in a Bible with them as an individual. This is according to the law. No. This, can I answer it? Yeah, I'm saying that there will be and there can be a discrepancy between the individual practice of the people at the customs and the airports and what the actual law states. What I'm telling you is what the actual law states, and I know, personally, I know Christians who have brought in Bibles themselves. So I know according to the law, not just because they managed to sneak it in, but according to the law itself, legally speaking, there is an allowance on the books. Okay, wait a minute, before we get off too far with that, right? The point is that the discrepancy between, you know, individual practices of individuals and what is actually on the law books, that is something, I mean, I cannot address that. You know, that is a problem which has to be worked out. People who are coming in who belong to companies, where the companies know what their rights are, can make that insistence when it's confiscated that it can be returned or whatever if they want to pursue it. But it's something, according to the law, that permission is there. Now, in terms of the sending in of religious materials into the country, if a person has this material being sent in, there are no guarantees that this may not be a part of a missionary activity. And this is what personally is prohibited here. It is prohibited for one to be involved in missionary activity in the sense of, you know, distributing literature, etc., or setting up institutions, etc., which are Christian or Jewish or other institutions. But you practicing personally yourself, you reading the Bible, praying in your home, what, etc., this is your individual right. And that is where the country has drawn the line.
Well, the Bible teaches that we should gather together to share our experiences with our Lord. And that is our teaching as Christians. And the Bible tells us, look how beautiful and wonderful it is for the brethren to dwell together in harmony. In other words, they come together and they join and they share. So that our faith in God will grow for those that are weaker. My experience personally with God, when I experience it with my fellow Christians, and get them to say, well, the Lord did it for him, he can do it for me too, and their faith will grow. But we are forbidden of doing this. I'm not saying that I want to come to this country and start preaching abroad, because I know it's illegal. But still, if I wanted to have a concordance sent over here, more than likely it would not make it. If I had a Bible dictionary sent over here, more than likely it would not make it, because it would get confiscated. And that does not mean that I'm doing missionary. I'm doing my own study.
Well, as I said, you know, you as a personal individual, you see that as a personal restriction. But the laws are there trying to govern the overall situation. And for you, for example, to get together with another friend of yours or another two friends of yours, you know, in your room and worship God together, or, you know, and share your experiences, this is not prohibited in this country. You know? And, I mean, the bottom line is that as an individual, nobody is forced to give up their religion or to stop the practice of their religion. There may be some restrictions in terms of what you are free to do back in your own country and what you are not free to do here. But this is something, when we join organizations, when we become a part of institutions, there are certain restrictions that are put on us. And we accept those restrictions. Those who have come over here to work, you know ahead of time that these are some of the restrictions. If you don't wish to be under a circumstance with these restrictions, that is your choice. I mean, that's the bottom line. The practice of individuals leaving the country, you know, which contravenes Islamic law, that is the choice of individuals. You see, the law itself cannot make a person pious. That is their relationship with God. The sincerity of their relationship will determine the level of their piety. So it doesn't mean that because the law in this country is such that you cannot purchase alcohol openly, though you may be able to go into some people's homes, and there are some people here who are producing it themselves or bringing it in one way or another. It is here. If you search hard enough, you may find it, you know. So it's not to say that it doesn't exist in the society as a whole, but the general situation is that it's not readily available in the society. This is for the protection and help of the people in general. Those people who choose to comply with the law when they're here out of force because of fear of the law, but when they find themselves in another circumstance where they're free to do as they please, they do so. This is the nature of human beings. I mean, all you have to do, I mean, myself, you look at the incidents which happened in Los Angeles. When the police, initially after the Rodney King issue, the ruling, when the city went haywire and the police didn't act immediately, and people realized that the police were not acting, everybody joined in. Same thing in New York City. When I went to New York City, it was back in early 80s, when the power grid went down. For 2 days, there were no lights. Everybody went wild. They were busting in, you know, I mean, people were even driving down with their Mercedes. They were hitting the first stores and the jewelry stores. The poor people were hitting the regular grocery stores, gathering food. But everybody went haywire. Why? Why weren't they doing that before? Because the force of the law, with fear of being caught, keeps them in line, keeps them in check. It's not everybody who did it. Not everybody did it. Because other people, there are people who didn't take part because they knew it was wrong. It don't matter whether the law sees you or it doesn't see you, it's wrong. So, you know, this is, nobody's saying this is heaven.
Hey, what about the situation in Sudan right now? I read it in Time magazine last month.
Situation in, pardon?
Sudan.
Sudan, yes.
There seems to be persecution of Christians being forced out of the south, out of the city, and now it looks like virtual open warfare against Christians by the people in power. Is this a case of Islam, or is this a personal excess of the people in charge?
Okay, in the case of Sudan, I mean, you're dealing with a number of political factors. One, to determine what is actually going on there is not that easy. Just like if you read the newspaper as to what is going on in Israel, you get a completely different picture than going down in Israel and seeing what's actually going on. You know? So the media, which is reporting for, you know, who have been involved in very heavy missionary activity in the South, and the vast majority of the people of the South are not Christians, the vast majority are animists, but the missionary activity which has been going on, they're supporting John Garang, you know, who started a secessionist movement there. It is in the interest of those people to promote a concept that it is a war against Christians. But in fact, as far as I know of visit to the Sudan, of Sudanese, there is no animosity towards Christians. But the splitting off of John Garang and the, you know, the SPLA, I mean, this is a political move to where he's seeking to set up his own country. You know, it's a political move which has used the issues of Christianity, you know, to support and gain support for itself. This is my view. You know, as I said, you asked me what is my view. This is what I see as my view. I mean, I'm not saying that the removal of the shanty towns around Khartoum, the relocation of the people, that some errors may not have taken place in the process, but I don't believe that this is directed specifically at Christians per se. I don't believe so. But again, as I said, that's my opinion.
It was 1988, 1989, Sudan declared Sharia law, or their intention to do Sharia law. And you and I live by basically the Sharia principles. But what it has done, and I can understand where the Christians are coming from, I was one myself at one time, you're having the principles of Sharia rammed down your throat. Now, it is a fact of life. Once Sharia law takes place in a country, you will live by it or you will go to jail. Example, somebody gets intoxicated, an idiot. You are arrested. There's a public drunkenness. Okay? Even if you're just tipsy. You're taking over. In the Quran itself, and there are things that are legal for you that are not legal for them. And there are things that are legal for them that are not legal for you. Alright? The institution of Sharia law wipes out that ayat.
Okay. I would add that many months ago, the Sudanese leadership stated that they were prepared that the southern regions would not come under Sharia law. Sharia law would only be applied in the majority Muslim regions. But Garang, that was not enough. When they sat at the tables, this is one of the things which were offered as a means to stop the warring and the fighting. They offered that. This is one of the proposals. But cessation, separation was the program of John Garang. Okay, we could talk about Canada and talk about U.S. also, you know, same situation, right? Same situation, I mean, in North America, a Muslim may practice some of his religion, he cannot practice all of his religion freely. Because if I, as a Canadian or an American, decide that I want to marry four women and look after them, you know, according to Islamic law, because marriage to four women doesn't mean one wife and three girlfriends, it means four wives who you have to look after equally. You have to provide homes, food, shelter, you know, money, look after the children. It's full responsibility. If I choose to do that, I am ruled a bigamist. I can go to jail. But wait a minute. I'm just responding to the question. Okay, let me finish. Okay? But... No doubt. I'm not questioning that. You know, I'm not questioning the right of America or Canada to make that illegal. I'm not questioning it. Our friend here was just asking. He asked the question, am I free to practice my religion in Canada and America? And I'm saying to him, I'm not. I can practice it within the limits which are set by the laws of the country. However, if I decide to have one wife and three girlfriends, I'm perfectly okay. No, the law does not touch me at all. I'm legally a legal entity. But once I decide to marry these people, commit myself, responsibility to them, it is illegal. Okay. Huh? How do? Other than marriage? You have, for example, burial customs. For example, in the Muslim world, a person is not buried in a box. You know, you don't have to spend $2,000 to buy him, you know, special going away present, right? You know, you wrap the body in cloth, a hole is dug, and he's put in the ground. The law in North America says, you got to put him in a box. Okay, so I'm obliged. This is the law. So if my family dies in America, I put him in a box. I'm obliged. I'm not allowed to practice that aspect. You know, and we can go on. There are other aspects too, you know. But I'm not complaining against it, you know. I accept the same way I accept it. Hopefully, you know, you all who are here can accept that there are some restrictions. The religion of Islam, which we believe to be the final form of a message which was already brought by Jesus and Moses, as Jesus brought certain reformation, Muhammad brought certain reformation in deviation, believed deviation, which had taken place in Christianity. The primary deviation was that in relationship to God and His unity. Christianity evolved into a concept of Trinitarianism, and it was not always so. There was a struggle which existed in early Christianity between Arianism, led by the Bishop of Alexandria, Arius, and those of Rome and Greece who had accepted and had adopted a Trinitarian concept of God. So there was a struggle in early Christianity between the Unitarians and the Trinitarians. Islam, the Unitarians lost. In 325, the Nicene Council established that the Trinity was the law. People who were Unitarians were hunted down, declared apostates, their books were burnt, you know, and Trinitarian concept became widespread amongst Christians. Islam came bringing back people to the Unitarian concept of God being one, not having different aspects, but one God. And the other aspect, as is stated in the Quran, that Jesus was not God. Christianity fundamentally teaches that Jesus was God. God became man. A rationale was built around this. Adam's sin is inherited with all the generations. So many sins, so much that it's not possible for an individual to achieve salvation by himself. You know, human sacrifice is not sufficient. We need a divine sacrifice. God becomes man, sacrifices himself for his own pleasure to give salvation to human beings. That's the rationale. From the Islamic point of view, when Adam committed the error of eating from the forbidden tree, he and Eve, they were taught words of forgiveness. They turned back to God in forgiveness. They were forgiven. There is no inherited sin. No son carries the sin of his father, or father carries the sin of the son. So it removed this concept. So salvation now became attainable by each and every individual. Each individual can turn to God in sincere repentance and can achieve salvation. No intermediaries, no switchboard that we have to go through to get to God. So Islam came removing the intermediaries, bringing people back to a direct relationship between themselves and God, clarifying that God does not become his creation. Because when we say God becomes his creation, then the Hindu who believes that God, you know, is manifest in a cow or in a statue, you know, or some other pagans who believe he's manifest in a tree, I mean, these are all aspects of creation. And if you can accept him as being a man, why can't you accept him as being a cow or being a stone? You know, it's just your own tradition which insists that, no, he was a man, but he wasn't a cow. But no, from Islamic tradition, no, God does not become his creation. He is the creator, and the creation is distinctly different from him. Our relationship to him is submission and worship of him. So that is the area in terms of the relationship between God and man, which Islam came to clarify and bring back to the tradition which was taught by Moses and the earlier prophets. Well, included in that, of course, is the issue of the saints, you know, the intermediaries, which it developed within early Christianity, Catholicism, which was rejected later by Protestantism, but, you know, exists within at least half of the Christians of the world. Islam rejected that issue also of sainthood. Okay. Let me get somebody who didn't ask the question. Okay. Did you ask the question before?
Talking about the freedom from Christians in the Muslim temple. Another friend talking about the freedom from Christians came up here. That's why they have the right to express their question. But I would ask some of them, especially from Europe and the States, 5 years ago, 3 French girls, they are Muslim, and they come out and say, they are joining one school. All the French society turned over to these three girls after. We know France, that's a country of freedom, equality, brotherhood. The French society couldn't bear such three girls to be there.
Covering their hair, scarves.
And the same also happened in the United Kingdom, that you know Salman Rushdie and his fucking quote, that the Italian person. You see that? And that him. Khomeini of Iran at this time announced that $1 million will cap the head of Salma Rushdie. All the European society turned off. They are weeping and they are sorry for the freedom of expression and the freedom of opinion. We compare the same situation. And in the United States, for example, what happened for the God here? They are sympathized with the Kuwait people. They are weak people, and we have to help the Kuwait people to liberate their land. At the same time, millions and thousands of Muslim people in Bosnia and Herzegovina are killed and slaughtered now. What the United States and the European mentality and the political person, the leaders, presidency, all don't care. That's inferior idea. Do you think, that's a question for me to you, the naked generation would be a generation of war between Christians and Islam?
Myself, you know, I cannot say, I mean, that is in the hands of God. If it turns out to be, well then, that was what was destined. But let me add, also, just to the same idea that you're developing, I know in Philadelphia, a Muslim woman, teacher, who wore a scarf, not covering her face or anything, just wearing a scarf, covering her hair. She was told by the school board, the school administration, to remove her scarf. She's not allowed to wear the scarf because it is an expression of, it is propagating her religion. Okay? Because Christians who wear a cross must, they put it inside their shirt. They cannot wear it out because it's propagating. Similarly, a Jew, if he's wearing a Star of David, got to wear it inside. But now, a Muslim woman wearing a scarf is something compulsory in the religion. Whether you wear a cross outside or inside does not make a distinction. You know, it doesn't make you less of a Christian because you wore it inside or outside. But wearing a scarf, taking off that scarf, is prohibited for a Muslim woman. And for not only did the school insist on that, but the school board agreed, and Muslim women who wanted to wear scarves either had to take off the scarf to work out of necessity because they had families to feed, or they had to quit the teaching profession. So, I mean, this was just, I'm just adding this to what our brother was saying in terms of certain restrictions which do occur in the West, you know, concerning the practice. I mean, though people talk about freedom of religion, it is truly limited. It is limited, no doubt.
We're talking a lot about isolated in your country and in mine. All right? We were supposed to come here and talk about different characteristics and cultures of this country. Okay? We've got down here to the point that you're talking just men back and forth, well, all of us really, because you are speaking. But it's his attitude is your, what your attitude is about it. What his attitude is, this man over here is at. Okay. We're coming down to isolated incidents and single conversations. And I've got things to do today besides sit here. Okay?
Point taken.
I was just going to echo that. You're going far out of the realm of the
original
lecture from the scholar that's our guest here. We are not going to solve politics or individuality. The gentleman who here has taken time you come here for a specific reason to brief us on the culture and the customs of Saudi Arabia. Limit your questions to that part, and I think that we can carry this over a little bit better. We're not interested in what happens to the rest of the world. Right here with us, here now for our own job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Sure, I mean, I just wanted to add that myself, that, you know, though everybody understands before coming in here what the laws are, it's natural curiosity for people to try to understand why. What are the reasons behind it? So, I mean, I don't find any offense in people questioning and asking, you know, why, you know, and I don't think really it's fair to really take any offense in that sense. Because people are just seeking to understand, because the better you understand the rationale, the reasoning, the better you can deal with it, you know, that's what it is. So anyway, I think, you know, maybe we'll talk to this privately, okay? Because I think now, I mean, many of you are getting restless, I think the conversation has sort of reached its peak, you know, and I know you're getting hungry and food's around the corner, so let me just close things down now, thanking you, you know, for coming and, you know, and sharing in this discussion. I hope that it was of overall benefit to you all, and I hope if anything I said, you know, was offensive to you, please accept my apologies, because I really did not mean any offense. And similarly, anything which you said, I would not take as offensive or intended to be offensive. Thank you very much.